Welcome to this conversation. I'm your host, Teresa Keller, and my guest today is Dr. Amy Sorensen. And Dr. Sorensen is on the faculty at Emory and Henry College. She's also leading some major progressive activities and programs here at Emory and Henry, and we're going to learn all about that as soon as we say, Dr. Amy Sorensen, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you so much, and I'm so happy to be here.
Well, good. And you are on the faculty. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And how long have you been here?
This 6 years. 6 years.
Do you know what? I retired 6 years ago. So
we just missed each other.
We just missed each other. But you've been in the news of Emory and Henry lately because you, well, first of all, it's Women's History Month. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about that. But you all opened and dedicated a new women's center at Emory and Henry.
We certainly did. This has been in the works for a very long time. It has come through major iterations throughout the years with different women predominantly giving their energy and their love and attention to this project. And so we finally found a space to bring it in. And so we're really excited to finally see the culmination of all those years of work from all those women.
So where is the location of this new center?
Currently, we are housed within Damer House, which is the White House behind the Merck. That's where DEIB also is. So we're sharing space there with DEIB and the Women's Center.
All right. So you are in charge of the Women's Center?
I'm the director.
You're the director of the Women's Center. What happens in that Women's Center?
Well, we don't know everything already. So just starting out, you know, we had our grand opening this past weekend, which was exciting. We've named the center after Helen Matthews Lewis, who, of course, is considered to be the grandmother of Appalachian studies. She was an activist and an educator here in Southwest Virginia. She unfortunately passed away just a couple of years ago in Abingdon in the Elder Spirit community. So we're really thrilled that during our opening, we were able to bring some of her colleagues to speak about her, and their anecdotes and stories really set home for us how we want to bring her spirit of how she functioned in the world to what we're doing. So there's that, and we've opened a period closet. So students and faculty and staff who maybe need period products at any given time can pop over to Damer and grab what they need for free. We'll be doing drives every now and then to collect donations for that. We sponsored students to go to the VFIC Leadership Summit back in the fall.
Which stands for Virginia Foundation of Independent Colleges?
Yes.
Okay, so you sent representatives there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we helped students pay for some of their transportation and all of that so that they could go do that. So we're hoping to really empower female-identified students and students within on the spectrum of gender, so trans or non-binary students, to be able to be empowered as leaders and thought provokers and just, you know, giving them that extra edge.
Okay, we have a ton to talk about from what you've just said, but let's don't get off the topic of Helen Matthews Lewis too quickly.
Okay.
Because she was from Southwest Virginia. You want to honor how she interacted in the world. What did she do? What's the big deal about this woman?
She was a sociologist, so of course that speaks to me. She was also an educator. She worked, she taught at whatever the iteration of UVA was before UVA was.
It was
UVA
called Clinch Valley College back then.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes. She taught there. She was also a labor activist. She was really active in advocating for minors' rights here in Southwest Virginia. She worked internationally as well with minors in Wales and Southwest Virginia, so she did a lot of international work in bringing those groups together. And I actually was not very familiar with her, other than, you know, the grandmother of Appalachian studies, prior to our event this past weekend. However, her colleagues came and spoke stories of her, and I was really impressed with the way that she was not happy to keep it in the classroom, right? She brought students out into the communities to work, which I think really goes well with what we do here at Emory and Henry. She brought people together. She went out into communities. She tried to attack problems that were actually problems. So she didn't keep academia in academia. And I love that idea of being a resource for our community at the same time that we're practicing academics.
So it's not just theory. It's you're learning about principles of, I guess, organizing, labor unions, those kind of things. But she put it to practice. She was a hell-raising woman.
That's right.
She didn't stay in her place.
That's right. And, you know, one of the things that they talked about was the fact that she never let what her actual, like, credentials or history was, what those things were, keep her from doing something new. So even when there was something that seemed kind of out of reach for her, she would still do it and find a way to do it. And I think that is an amazing thing for us to really think about, is how we can break out of boxes that we create for ourselves, right? How we can break out of those boxes and be more than.
Let's break out of the boxes for a minute. You know, I made the comment that she didn't stay in her place. So is that a thing still, Dr. Sorensen, that the society somehow sends messages to women, stay in your place, don't make trouble?
I do think so, yes. I think it happens not just in the context of our campus, but globally and locally and nationally. Obviously, that's happening. We're being told to stay in our place. When we look at legislation, that's happened in recent years. I still have students that come to me at times talking about how they're being pressured from family members or family friends or people in their community about why are they going on to grad school, or, you know, when are they going to meet a nice young man and settle down and have some babies. And women are often trying really hard, I think, to juggle those kinds of expectations, which may also be the things that they want in life as well, but also being a career person or being able to do creative things or be able to be an athlete. So I do think that the world still tries to keep us in boxes. And I think that one of the things that we can do as a community is to help young women navigate those boxes and how you can jump out of them or stay in them if you want to be in them, right? But how we can help young women navigate that. But I don't think it's only young women. I don't think it's just our students that are experiencing that. I think that our faculty experiences that. I think that our staff experiences that. And again, not necessarily just in the context of our campus, but in the world at large as they're interacting. So I do think that it's still a thing that we deal with.
Well, I guess part of what you do is educate women. Mm-hmm. I know in my journey, and I'm going to ask you the same question, I remember being asked when I was in graduate school, had I experienced sexism? And I said no. And this was at a time when women weren't allowed on the floor of the National Press Club. There were virtually no women in public office. I had never seen, couldn't imagine a woman lawyer and those kinds of things. So you first have to be able to see the world you're living in. What was your story? You're from Southwest Virginia, too.
I am.
How did you get activated?
Well, I was very fortunate to be raised in a family that was very matriarchal. So we had strong female family members that led our family to a large part. But I too wouldn't have noticed sexism when I was younger because I was largely insulated from it at home. But it you know, my mother was a do everything woman, but we didn't talk about it. You know, like we didn't talk about it. So I didn't see it until I was much older. And I actually got married to my first husband very young. I got married at 17 and had four children and was a single mom after I got rid of him by divorce. But yeah, after we split up, I raised four kids by myself. So a lot of the sexism that you run into also intersects with classism, right? Because I was raised in poverty and I spent most of my adult life also in poverty. So you have that intersection and you don't always know where the sexism stops and the classism starts and how they overlap. So there was a lot of that. And I think that activation for me, I was always active in trying to create equality in the world. You know, I joined Amnesty International when I was in high school. But I think for recognizing the localization of sexism, it did not happen until I became involved in domestic violence, right? When I left my first husband, I utilized a domestic violence program to get away. And at that time, I was finally in a room with women who were talking about these issues and the ways that poverty was impacting women and the ways that motherhood was impacting women and the way that domestic violence is impacting women. And that kind of started the synapses firing about still being in a box I didn't know I had been in.
Coming to terms with this, recognizing this, is something that is part of what's going to be happening at your women's center. But I want to tell you that on this campus, I can remember, of course, I've been here for a long time, and it was a long time ago, but a male faculty member saying, "Women's studies. Why do you need women's studies? You're just going to stir up trouble." What would be your response to that man from those many years ago?
Hopefully. I really hope so. I hope we stir up all kinds of trouble. Good trouble, as Mr. Lewis would have said, right? And, you know, we still haven't escaped that. I don't know, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, so if you have to edit it, okay?
Go for it.
But, you know, WCYB did a short story about the opening and posted it on their Facebook page. And if you go in and read the comments, wow.
Oh, really? So these still the same kind of comments. What?
Yeah.
What the heck is a women's center? Why do you need it?
Yeah, why do you need it? And the fact that we included gender in our title, because that really threw people into a tizzy. What do you need a gender center for?
Well, let's talk about that then. Let's jump right to that, because you said women who people who self-identify as female.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to send shivers up people's spine. What the heck are you talking about? So talk us through that. You said a spectrum. LGBTQ people freak out about that. Why do people need to calm down?
Well, we want to make sure that we're inclusive and that we're creating an environment where everyone can get what they need from the center. And I think that applies to everyone around our campus, right? It's not, while our goal is to empower women and female-identified students, we also want to make sure that we are supporting our trans and non-binary community, because gender can be fluid and it can be different for different people. And we want to make sure that we are approaching all of those issues and creating a space that feels warm and fuzzy and good and supportive, right?
Okay, now that's where people would stop you, Dr. Sorensen. People are born male or female. Mm-hmm. So you're just encouraging people to be confused, and you're trying to tear apart family values.
Mm. I try not to give too much credence to folks, and I'm not the world's best at trying to lay these things to rest, but that's just not based in reality, right? This idea that there's only male or female, and feminine gender roles necessarily go with female anatomy. Like, that is, it's just not realistic. When we look at the complexity of the world, whether we're talking about within our own species or within other species throughout the world, it's just not how it actually works. And we know that femininity or masculinity are social roles that we're asked to fill, and we learn them, and we keep what we find useful and we discard what we don't. And I think that we know now that there is so much more freedom to understand and explore who we are, our identities. There's so much more room for that now that maybe we didn't have when we were younger. There wasn't a lot of freedom for that. And I think that freedom is beautiful, and I want to make sure that we are allowing that exploration to happen.
Students come to you and say they are questioning their sexual identity. Instead of saying, "You don't know what you're talking about," you say what?
We say, "Okay, let's talk about that." Or, you know, what do you need? You know, do you need more information? Do you need resources? Do you need a group of people to talk to? Do you just need someone to talk to? Like, what do you need to help be a catalyst for whatever self-awareness that you are exploring right now? It doesn't have to be about sexuality. It doesn't have to be about gender. We want students to be able to come to Emory and Henry and explore who they are.
Let me ask you, how does the Women's Center interact with the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Center?
Because I am the director of both of those things, there is necessarily some interaction. They are not under the same supervision structure. Women and gender minorities and people in the LGBTQ plus community are part of the people that we support through DEIB. And then there's also going to be this additional Women's and Gender Center. We do a lot of programming together to try to be budget efficient. We understand that intersections are important, right? So DEIB is where we serve students of color. And if the Women's and Gender Center is where we serve women, you know, we have women of color that need to be served. So there's a lot of overlap as far as who we serve.
I would think that the challenge would be that people have to come to you. You don't give academic credit, I'm assuming, for the activities at the Women's Center, or do you?
It depends, right? A lot of our programming is Lyceum, so you can get your Lyceum credit for attending. And then we also have the Women and Gender Studies minor, so there's that academic side. We also are rolling out the DEIB concentration, which will start next fall. So there is an academic side to it for getting credit.
I think the problem in communicating to the outside world is exactly what you're supporting. What is it that people are going to need the most when they come to you?
If we're talking specifically about the Helen Matthews Lewis Center, I think that a lot of the students that have already chimed in for what they want from a Women's and Gender Center, female-identified students wanted a place where they felt safe to study, especially after dark, because they don't really feel safe making that long trek from MS back over to, the townhouses. So they were really excited to think there might be a space where you could study quietly without having, you know, 1,000 people around you, but also where you didn't have to be frightened. So that's one of the things. The period closet was also something that students requested. Students have also requested opportunities for mentorship and trainings and workshops and access to leadership skills.
I'm glad you mentioned the thing about safety, because you wouldn't think, people who are from here think, oh, Emory's so safe. But people who come from urban areas and they're, you know, in this dark, big space out in the country may not feel safe. And next month, April, is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell you a story that I just heard. I was talking to a graduate of mine who graduated a number of years ago. She was assaulted, and she didn't ever tell anyone because she didn't think that people would believe her. Is that something specifically that you address? Sexual assault and safety on campus?
Yes. In fact, some of our early programming, since next month is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, one of our early programs, we've been working on doing lyceums that are held at lunchtime in the BOV. So students or faculty and staff can go into the cafeteria, grab their lunch, and join us for a lunch and learn. So on April the 3rd at 12:30 in the BOV, we'll be hosting a Lyceum workshop called Aftermath, and it will be bringing in folks from Abuse Alternatives and our Title IX office and the Counseling Office and DEIB and the Women's and Gender Center to give a training on what to do after sexual assault has happened. Because very often we try to prevent sexual assault, obviously, but sometimes we don't give enough information about what to do if it's happened to you or someone you know. So who to call, what your options are, how to support someone, how to talk about these things. And I think that's really important programming. So we're jumping right into that.
You know, this your center might address this, but this woman told me, you know, that she didn't think people would believe her, mm-hmm. and she felt like that the institution didn't care. Who could she trust? So I'm assuming that this would be a perfect example of a message that we care, that we do care. You can trust us.
Yes, I hope so. Because, you know, that is something that sexual assault survivors, regardless of where they are, report, right? That they're afraid of not being believed or of the institution not supporting them. And unfortunately, it's often true. So I want us to have a different kind of environment here at Emory and Henry. And I feel really excited about Yancey Wilmoth, who is our new Title IX coordinator. And my office has been working with her pretty closely to try to make sure that we develop all of the skills that we need in order to support students, and so that we have a good rapport between our office and her office to continue supporting students, so that students do get to start building that trust.
Let's start with answering the question that you posed, or the topic that you posed, which is, what is the first thing someone should do if they're sexually assaulted?
First of all, I will say that I am not an expert in that. I am kind of the conduit for this conversation. But I think that the most important thing for someone to do after a sexual assault is to make sure that they have someone they trust to be able to talk to, and not try to keep that to themselves. The burden is overwhelming when we feel like we have to be silent. Does that have to be someone that reports? It does not. It can be so any person that you trust, but you need to have someone that you can trust, that you can talk to about it, and then to walk with you as you make these decisions. Because there are hard decisions about whether to report, whether not to report, whether to file charges or just go through the institutional. There's so many decisions. So for me, the first thing is to take care of yourself by having someone to be able to talk and support you while you're going through all of the channels that occur afterwards, and to not try to do that alone.
What is sexual assault? I mean, you think of rape as sexual assault, but there's a lot of other activity that is considered assault.
Absolutely. Sexual assault is any sexual activity that is unwarranted or unwanted, right? So it could be when someone smacks you on the rear, like that can be sexual assault, right? Sexual harassment, those things kind of move together. It can be unwanted sexual attention. It can be any number of things. So it can take a lot of different forms.
And some of those things, even though they may not sound as serious as rape, can have long-term consequences. What have you seen along
Absolutely.
Those lines?
I think one of the things that stuck out the most to me in recent years has actually been related to things that I've seen on social media, where you have a large outpouring of women who are responding to something, and they're talking about the first time they experienced sexual harassment or sexual assault, and what that was like for them. And so just being shared those stories of, you know, I was a teenager and I was walking down a street, or I was 5 and I was wearing my fuzzy pajamas. The way that social media has been able to bring light to that in recent years, I think has been really impactful for all of us. I hope for all of us.
So you're talking about social media in a good way, that it sheds light on something important that needs attention.
Yeah, I do think so. Social media, like most things, can be harnessed for good or evil.
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the things that's been really great about social media is creating platforms for people who have often been rendered invisible. And I think that that has been true for a lot of women's issues and women platformers, like, say, on TikTok or Instagram, YouTube. I think that they've found a platform there to raise awareness about women's issues.
What do you know about the statistics on sexual assault?
I do know that 1 out of 4 women will experience sexual assault in the United States at some point in their lives. And for women with disabilities, that number actually goes up to 3 out of 4 to 75%.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
We probably should also mention that men are sexually assaulted too. And I think that maybe what a lot of people might be thinking when they hear all this discussion about Women's Center, Women's History, sexual assault, all those kind of things is, well, what about men?
That's true. And so hopefully what we can do at the center is we want to make sure that, as I mentioned earlier, we want to make sure that we support everyone. So when it comes to sexual assault, of course, the Women and Gender Center is not going to be the place where you go to report sexual assault, right? That's still going to be Yancey Wilmoth and Title IX and counseling and those professionals, that's their area. But we do know that, that one out of three men experience sexual assault at some point in their lives as well. So making an environment where men feel comfortable to come to us and say, what do I do? And then we can point you in the right direction or towards someone with whom you can talk. We also know that men experience domestic violence. So I don't want the name of the center to stop anyone from seeking what they need. I think the important thing about the Helen Matthews Lewis Center is that we want to make sure that everyone has a good understanding of gender and what is impacting particular groups.
Let's go back to your story. We left off when you divorced and you raised four children. Somewhere along there, you got a PhD and established a career. So what brought you to that?
I didn't start college until I was in my 30s. I was a non-traditional student. And honestly, when we really think about it, a whole lot of stars had to align for that to happen, right? It, some of the legislation that occurred in the mid to late 90s made it so it was possible for me, as someone who received government benefits, to be able to afford to go to college and still keep my children alive. And so that's what I did. I went and got my bachelor's degree through, at the time, it was a brand new program, the Regents Online Degree Program through ETSU, which allowed me to do all of my undergraduate coursework online so I could be home with my kids and do that coursework. And afterwards, I went and took a job at the Department of Social Services in Tennessee. I was in Tennessee at the time. I hadn't been there very long when I got a phone call from someone at the graduate school at ETSU that said, hey, you know, you did really well in your undergraduate program. Would you be interested in getting a master's degree? I was like, oh, that's crazy. Like, I can't afford that. And they said, oh, don't you know, we pay you.
Whoa, okay.
And I said, okay, sign me up. So I got my master's in sociology through ETSU, and I applied for one PhD program. I put all my eggs in the one basket. I said, if it's meant to be, I'll get in and get an assistantship. So I did. I got in and got an assistantship at Virginia Tech to get my PhD in sociology, and I did that next. And then
Emory and Henry?
Well, no. After that, I spent a year in Chicago at the University of Illinois at Chicago in a postdoctoral appointment in disability studies. And then I actually worked in the nonprofit world for 2 years while I waited for something academic in the region to open up because I had come back home. So I worked with, I worked in a child and infant health program in Radford. And then I went to Radford for 3 years and taught at Radford, and then I came to Emory and Henry.
Well, welcome to Emory and Henry. Yeah. Dr. Amy Sorensen, it's been nice talking to you. A reminder that it's Women's History Month, that we need to be aware of sexual assault coming up in April to call attention to those issues, and that above all, what I'm hearing from you is that you want everybody, no matter what, to feel safe and cared for.
Yes.
Thank you for your time. Thank you very much for your time, and good luck in your work.
Thank you.
And thanks above all to the listeners for tuning in. This is This Conversation. You can hear us Wednesdays at 6, Sundays at 2. You can find us on the podcast. Just say WEHC Podcast, This Conversation. Thanks for tuning in. See you next time.